8, and I think it'd be good to begin at this point. The topic for this week's Bible study is discipleship in the New Testament. This morning, what I would like to do is introduce a thesis, not only the topic, but the way in which I want to proceed in handling that topic. And this morning's teaching will be then divided into two parts. I want to summarize what I consider to be the problem with the topic, discipleship in the New Testament. And then I want to propose a framework for solving that problem. And I'm hoping that in this introductory teaching, you will be stimulated not only to come back for tomorrow and through the rest of the week, but also we will have some interesting discussion this morning about some of the things that we raise. Leonhard Gophelt, great German New Testament scholar, has said that the most revolutionary demand ever issued by a Jewish rabbi was that demand issued by Rabbi Yeshua ben Yosef, who called his followers to follow after me. No Jewish rabbi had the chutzpah to that point ever to call Jews to follow him. Rabbis rather called the worshiping community to follow God, to follow God's Torah, to follow the traditions that God had given through the prophets to the forefathers and foremothers of the faith. Never follow me. And yet Jesus made that demand of those who came out of that Palestinian world to listen to his word as a messianic word, as a word from God. And Jesus' demand to follow after him continues to frame what is the essential identity of the church. So that indeed throughout the history of Christianity, the recurrent quests after answers to those pivotal questions, what does it mean to be the church and to do as the church ought, are framed by some kind of understanding of that demand given by Jesus to follow him. And yet, what does this mean exactly? As one rehearses the history of Christianity, one finds that problems of definition abound. What exactly does it mean to be a disciple of Jesus? Now, part of this stems from methodological difficulties. Each method of inquiry itself rooted in a particular kind of knowing. And also in theological differences and disagreements, which are rooted in traditional and experiential differences. Problems of definition abound. What does it mean exactly to follow? There are conceptual and existential difficulties, especially now in this particular culture. To follow after someone is inherently problematical. To submit to anyone other than ourselves for some is a difficult existential problem. What exactly are we to follow after? Are we to follow after the character of Jesus or the teaching of Jesus? Are we to do what Jesus did before us? What exactly are we to follow after? Another conceptual problem, a problem of definition. Who is it that we are to follow after? Well, we say Jesus, but which Jesus? The historical Jesus? Perhaps you are reading in the newspapers the yield of the ongoing Jesus seminar. Have you read about the Jesus seminar in your papers? Gathering together of various scholars of the New Testament gospel, with the single objective of determining which of the teachings that we find on the lips of the biblical Jesus were actually uttered by the historical Jesus. And of course, that is, and they rate them, you know, A through E, and they give them various colors so that if it's likely, really likely, really probable that teaching we find in the Bible on the lips of Jesus was actually uttered by the historian, then it will appear in red. And then some are in pink, and then some are in black. You can get an idea of which belongs to which. And that really has been the objective of the last 150 or 200 years of biblical scholarship, the quest after the historical Jesus. Most often this quest has been without any kind of theological justification. That is to say, once the historical Jesus is recovered, then what? It's just basically a quest for the historical Jesus. The assumption is that once we understand what it is that Jesus taught and how it is that Jesus lived, then we have someone to follow after. There are others who follow after the biblical Jesus, or one portrait of Jesus found within the New Testament. So some follow after Luke's portrait of Jesus. They follow after, or some follow after John's Jesus, or Paul's Jesus. Question of definition. Some follow after an enculturated Jesus. So that one of the problems that we need to stake out in any kind of discussion of Christian discipleship is a problem of definition. But there's also problems of application. How is any of this meaning that we have recovered from biblical texts actually meaningful where the rubber meets the road? When I was in seminary, the question that was constantly pressed after we had done all of this exegesis, whether it was in exegetical class or in preaching class, the assumption was that you worked with the biblical texts and you looked at those texts and reflected on those texts from a number of different vantage points. But the question that the professors constantly zeroed in on was, so what? What does any of this meaning have to do with the life of the congregation or with your own life as interpreter? Even if we are able to find the historical Jesus, even after we have studied and become familiar with the various biographies of him found within the New Testament, is it possible for a white, middle-class, North American male Bible scholar to follow after a Palestinian holy man, a Galilean itinerant rabbi of peasants and fishermen? What does a blue-collar Messiah have to do with a white-collar existence? The problem of application. And the end result, as we continue to struggle as a people of God with these problems of definition and of application, most of us, I think, engage in a kind of Christological reductionism. That is to say, we take a little bit of Jesus over here, and we take a little bit of Jesus over there, and we build our own Jesus model on the basis of our wants, on the basis of our traditions, on the basis of our experiences, on the basis of our innate sensibilities. Ryan, H. Richard Niebuhr speaks of three functional Unitarianisms within the church as a wonderful little book on the Trinity. When one looks across the church, one finds certain congregations more Reformed, perhaps Lutheran, Presbyterian, whose understanding of their faith and of their life, their discipleship, is really controlled not so much by Jesus from Nazareth as it is by the God of Jesus from Nazareth. They follow God. And the yield of this kind of theocentric Unitarianism is an emphasis on God as creator. The internal calculus of their faith, driven by an idea of justification. And it's really a forensic notion of justification. That is to say, God's pronouncement of a right relationship with God on the basis of our faith in God's Christ. As you go to other congregations, perhaps more Baptistic, the central person of faith is Jesus. And the emphasis of discipleship is not so much on justification as it is on sanctification. It's rather on a life of witness rather than a coming together of a community of worship, as would be more the case for the Reformed tradition. So that within the more Baptistic or Anabaptistic congregations, community life is a life of witness, where life is patterned after the life of Jesus, the teachings of Jesus. In Pentecostal Christianity, it is the Spirit of God that is central. And the calculus of faith is more experiential. It is the experience of power, the experience of God's kingdom, which drives their own religious identity. When I do a series on the life of Jesus, as I have done several in several different congregations, one of the exercises that I sometimes have them engage in is the reconstruction of a part of the story of Jesus from scratch, from memory. They can't use their Bibles. They have to gather together in groups of four and five to reconstruct from memory the Easter story. And it's very fascinating to me to find what the yield of those little groups. We come back and we share what each narrative is. And it's amazing what one finds. One finds in some a little bit of Matthew and a touch of Luke, and you find some of these things that get into that really are not found anywhere in the Bible. They just happen to come in, part of maybe an ongoing tradition of thinking about Easter. And I think that most of us, if we were to understand the gospel, or if we were to proclaim or write down our version of the gospel of God or of life of Jesus or a conception of what it means to be a follower of Jesus, would find that it really is a synthesis based upon these various kinds of forces and factors that have shaped us as persons, shaped us as believers. Now, the problem then is more than simply a problem of definition, a problem of application. It is the very practical problem that when one looks across the church Catholic, one finds disagreements over what counts, disagreements over how Christian disciples are made and formed, what their identity is. Now, we talked a little bit about this at the staff Bible study, and most were not at all discouraged or displeased or felt that to be a problem, and perhaps many of you are in that same camp. And yet what I have found is that there is an inability to reconceive and to reimagine this diversity in positive and constructive ways within the whole church. If one looks at the ecumenical movement, for instance, one finds that the force of the movement is to try to find that which unifies us all. There is not really a whole lot of celebration of the contraries that provides the primary impetus in the ecumenical movement. It is a quest after a common denominator, which is more often than not quite low and quite minimal. That's one way of solving the disagreements, to try to find in the midst of all of these disagreements that minimal core of beliefs, of convictions, of values that we all can assent to. Hardly a celebration of diversity. And in fact, if one group, and this has been my experience, maybe your experience is different, but my experience is that when one group begins to press a distinctive, when the Peace Church, for instance, begins to press a pacifism, which is a part of their own way of reading the biblical texts and their own understanding of what it means to be a disciple of a pacifist Christ, all kinds of disagreements. That's unacceptable. We won't have anything of that. There is then a kind of fundamentalism that one finds on the right, one finds on the left, and one finds everywhere in between. Difficulty living among a people who disagree with our understanding of what it means to be a disciple and to do as a disciple of Christ ought. Now that is a summary, and perhaps a too simplistic summary, but nevertheless some idea of the problem with trying to deal with in any kind of coherent way the idea of Christian discipleship. Christian discipleship in the church, Christian discipleship, the idea of discipleship within the New Testament. Now I want to provide for you a framework for a particular solution to this problem, and then hopefully we will have some time to talk and interact and to press certain points a little bit more deeply. Let me frame this discussion by the question, how can we learn to celebrate diversity? How can we learn to construct a more positive understanding of discipleship because of, not in spite of, but because of the disagreements that one finds even within the New Testament? The hermeneutical key, it seems to me, at least the key that I will play in during the next week, belongs to the late 2nd century of the Christian era. At that point, when the church began to discuss its need for a distinctively Christian canon, a distinctively Christian book, a New Testament. One of the things that I do right away when I teach my introduction to the New Testament class at the university is to demythologize what most of my students think about the beginnings of the Bible. It's amazing how many of them have not thought about that. And when they think about that, how many of them think that the New Testament one day fell out of the sky as though by magic? Or that Paul, one free Saturday afternoon, wrote the book of Romans for the New Testament? They don't think of the New Testament or the Christian biblical canon as the end product of a process. an intentioned process. That the church became convinced that because of various problems that it was experiencing, difficulties that it was trying to handle, that it needed a Bible. And that the church formed the Bible to deal with these various problems in its life, crises in its faith. Now, that process really got underway at the very moment that certain writings from the apostles were preserved by those earliest congregations of believers. But it wasn't until the second half of the second century that there was any thought of adding these writings, these apostolic writings, to the Bible of the church. Now, what was the Bible of the... what was Jesus' Bible? The Old Testament. And that was the Bible of the apostles, and that was the Bible of the earliest church, the Old Testament. And it would have probably been for Jesus something of a heresy for people to talk about opening that book up and adding other books to it. But it became an imperative as the church began to grow up, as the church became an above-ground institution of the social order rather than an underground movement at odds with the socio-political order. Now, I want to focus there as primary, that those intentions felt by the canonizing church, the church that formed our New Testament, I want to begin there as the primary location of those controls, those intentions, which measure meaning that we find from biblical texts. That any thinking that we do about the New Testament idea of discipleship must somehow be controlled by those intentions that brought about the New Testament in the first place. Now, this is somewhat at odds with those that place primary emphasis on finding the reasons why authors wrote their books, the author's intentions as primary, or those that find in the 20th century those interests or those crises which largely determine meaning. I think those are important and necessary interests, but they are secondary to the canonical intentions. That is, they are secondary to those very reasons why we have a New Testament. Now let me unpack those a little bit more. By the way, I think the work of Stanley Fish, there are two persons that are working in the same area. I love, one is Stephen Fowle, and the other is Stanley Fish, both British literary critics. They speak of a community of interpreters. And this community of interpreters is full of persons with different interests and different methods. And that whenever we talk about the meaning of, say, a biblical text, we must understand that every biblical text is multivalent. That is, it has many possible meanings. And that all of these various interpreters come to the same text, but with different interests, to exploit different meanings. And it is a community of possible meanings, then, a universe of possible meanings that give us some understanding of the whole truth of that text. And I agree with that. What I am going to do is to exploit one possible way of looking at the text as one interpreter in this community of interpreters. And my own interest in the biblical text and in the New Testament idea of discipleship is controlled by the idea of canon as that was formed by the canonizing church of the 2nd, 3rd, 4th centuries. Now, understanding that, let me speak of two different intentions. That is two different reasons why the church formed the New Testament. Why it gathered together various compositions that it had preserved, selecting from among those preserved a group of compositions that would then continue to function as canon, as standard, as rule, as that which is normative for Christian faith and Christian life. Charles Wood, the first of these two intentions or reasons, has been given its fullest understanding, it seems to me, by Charles Wood, who's a theologian at Perkins School of Theology in Dallas. In his essay titled Theological and the Formation of Theological Understanding, Wood argues that the church formed the New Testament for reasons of orthodoxy, bringing together a set of compositions which would transmit trustworthy content, so that by reading and hearing this biblical canonical word, the church's theological understanding, its understanding of God, of God's Christ, of God's Spirit, might be formed in trustworthy, in truthful directions. So that the determination was to bring together a set of compositions that could help the ongoing church know God and worship God in spirit and in truth. More recently, the work of Elizabeth Schussler Fiorenza has been most stimulating for me. She has argued in a set of works that the role of the Christian biblical canon has less to do with the transmission of trustworthy content than it does in the forming of a people who can live in truthful, in trustworthy ways. She is not so much interested in content as she is in consequences. It is what an interpretation produces in the life of a people of God which really counts. Her interest is not so much orthodoxy as it is orthopraxy. Now, it seems to me that these two discussions of the role of the Bible within the community of disciples are both important, and they both reflect the historic reasons why the church formed the New Testament. It was, on the one hand, to gather together a set of apostolic writings that would bear witness to the apostles' witness to the truth and the grace and the glory of God as incarnated in Jesus from Nazareth. Trustworthy content. The old notion of apostolicity. That is, whether or not a writing is apostolic, whether or not it's written by an apostle. That really was not as crucial as it is in the modern period. It rather has to do with whether or not a book rang with the truth that was remembered as proclaimed by the apostle who was God's authorized witness, normative transmitter of the truth revealed in Jesus from Nazareth. They also use this notion of inspiration. And this idea of inspiration in the early church had much more to do with utility. What is produced? Is it useful for worship? Is it useful for a variety of spiritual, of religious activities? Consequences. Does a text and one's interpretation of a text produce things that shape a trustworthy witness to God? So, if I can put this in sharp ways, the church formed the New Testament to form the church. The church formed the New Testament to form the church, to form a community who could give worship to God and who could bear witness to God that was trustworthy, competent, useful. Now, it seems to me that as we come to the New Testament, as interpreters, as believers, as we gather around the biblical texts together, accepting that this text bears trustworthy witness to Jesus, who is our Lord, the meanings that we make, the applications, the definitions that we find there, must be controlled by those very reasons why the church formed the New Testament in the first place. Meanings must produce, must nurture a community of disciples who worship God, who bear witness to God's gospel in truth and with effectiveness. Now, I want to this, massage this point a little bit more, this idea of canon, in several different directions. The first thing I would say, do y'all understand the basic point that I'm working with? Okay. As one looks again at that canonizing process, one notices right away that it is largely retrospective. That is to say, in the second, third century, the church looked back to the first century and to the witness of the apostles and the ministry of the apostles as primary, not only for the gathering of compositions, but also for the shaping of the New Testament itself. Which books were to be included, how those books were to be positioned. The very form of the New Testament is not an arbitrary thing. It is an element of the very process, the product yielded by that canonizing process. There is theological significance in the very way the books are positioned in the New Testament. And in the very books that we find in the New Testament. Largely the result of a retrospective look back to the first century. Now, let's take that up a little bit more. As the church looked back to the first century, and they used passages like Acts 15 and Galatians 2 to help them understand the ministry and the messages of the various apostles, they recognized immediately that the gospel of God, as it was preached by Jesus from Nazareth and rehearsed and re-signified by his apostles, did not envision or enshrine a monolithic monotheism. That is to say, they understood that God found God's people in a variety of ways, through a variety of messages, and that this variety resulted in a variety of responses of worship and of witness. What they found was not a monolithic monotheism. What they found was a pluralizing monotheism. A pluralizing monotheism. That diversity was at the very heart of the apostolic witness to the gospel of God. Acts 15, it seems to me, is a very important text. It has been called the watershed event of earliest Christianity. Acts 15 recounts in Luke's memory, the great first ecumenical synod held in the city of Jerusalem. Paul narrates it in Galatians 2. Turn, if you have your Bibles, turn with me to Acts 15, and we'll work with this text to illustrate the point, to justify the point that I just made. I have a Bible here. If you have time, you might put your finger in Galatians 2. You know the story? Acts 15, the story of the Jerusalem Council. The story actually begins in the Damascus Road Christophany of Acts chapter 9. Saul ravaging the church on his way to Damascus to persecute the Greek-speaking Jewish Christians. God finds Saul in a unique way through a vision of the risen Christ, who commissions Saul to become the missionary not only among Jews but among Goyim, among Gentiles. God shows God's hand at that point. And then that is followed by the conversion of Cornelius, first Gentile according to Luke's composition, under the preaching ministry of Peter, who himself had to receive a vision before he was willing to go to the Goy, to the non-kosher Cornelius. Remember the story of the picnic blanket coming out of the sky three times. Take, eat. Peter's first response was, "No way, Jose, I'm a kosher, law-abiding Jew. I'm not going to eat non-kosher food." Of course, that prepared him for ministry to non-kosher people. Well, Paul begins his ministry, now Paul, in chapter 13 and 14. And his ministry is law-free. It's tradition-free. And that went against Judaism. Judaism understood its devotion to God in terms of observing God's law, observing certain traditions, and even Gentile converts to Judaism would need to spend several years of study and probation as their Torah observant life was observed. And Paul said Gentiles can get into eschatological Israel by faith, by depending upon the Messiah's work as dependable, by trusting in it as trustworthy. And the Jewish believers had real problems. And they went to the apostolate, the leaders, those who were regents over Israel, the 12 apostles of the Jewish church. And they complained, and they called Paul and Barnabas onto the apostolic carpet. And they asked them to explain why it is that they are preaching a law-free, tradition-free gospel. Peter was the first to speak, 6 through 11. And Peter rehearses his experience of Pentecost that accompanied his conversion of Cornelius, Pentecost, deja vu. Or in Yogi Berra's words, deja vu all over again. And then Barnabas and Paul, especially Barnabas is mentioned first because I think it is Barnabas who is the one who bears witness to the signs and the wonders. Paul is a persona non grata in the Jewish church, in the Jerusalem church, so he keeps quiet. Barnabas, loyal child of that synagogue, talks about the signs and the wonders, a catchphrase for Luke, all of those events, those acts that bear, that are fulfillment of Joel's promise of a new age. The Spirit has been poured out, resulting in all of these signs and wonders in Gentile territory. Evidence number two. But it seems to me, in the way that Luke narrates this, that they are still not convinced. These converted Pharisees, these Judean believers, these Palestinian Jewish Christians, they're still not convinced. Peter, by this time, is no longer in power. He has left, according to chapter 12, verse 17. He is no longer in charge of the of the Palestinian church. James is. Barnabas has been tainted by his association with Paul. And so it's left to James. James takes the floor. He makes an assertion. He says the evidence is fairly clear that God is calling out for God's self a people from among the goyim. Gentiles are now included in the Israel of God. They are destined to enter into with other believing Jews the promises of God's Shalom. And then he cites an Amos text, and this is the logic. It's a bibliologic. James appeals to the one certain authority, the biblical text, the prophet, Amos. And he says, this is what Amos has foretold. God is now fulfilling God's promise as contained within the Amos text, that there is not only a house of David, God calling out for Israel, people from among the Jews, but also from among the nations. And then we come to James's great compromise, one of the most significant texts, I think, in understanding the New Testament as canon. Acts chapter 15, 19 through 20, 21. James says, on the basis of the evidences, existential, religious, as well as biblical, I want to say two things, and I have two conclusions. This is James's midrash, commentary on the biblical text. He says, with respect to the Gentiles, verse 19, we ought not to bother them with the law. We should allow Paul and Barnabas to continue to call out from among the Gentiles a people for God by the preaching of a law-free, tradition-free gospel. And then he goes on to say in verse 21 that among the Jews, we need to continue to preach Moses. That is the gospel preached by the Jewish apostles as part of a Jewish mission among the Jews, calling out for God a people from among the Jews, is law observant and tradition observant. Paul says the same thing, doesn't he, in Galatians chapter 2, verse 7, where he says that God has called me to preach the gospel among the uncircumcised, even as Peter has been called to preach a gospel among the circumcised. Now what I'm getting at here is that the apostolic witness to the gospel of God assumes theological pluralism. That there will be not one kerygma, not one gospel, but many kerygmata, many gospels preached in God's name from among various peoples, to call from various peoples a people of God. Now, what this helps, there are a set of observations I would make on this. It is my understanding that the very essence of an apostolic understanding of God and God's gospel is that the gospel is expressed in a diversity of ways by a diversity of voices. And as one looks at the New Testament, rather than to be discouraged, or rather than to be annoyed, or rather than to be alarmed at the diversity that one finds there, theologically or ethically, one ought to embrace it and celebrate it as the very intent of God. So that when we come to the New Testament, we should anticipate, we should look forward to a book that is composed of different voices,
written in different literary genre for different communities shaped by different mythologies, written from a perspective of differing sociologies, as different as the sociology of Paul is from the sociology of Peter. Think of how those two understood the relationship of the church and the state. Paul understood it as a Roman citizen. Peter understood it as a Galilean peasant. And I guarantee you, they understood the Roman state very differently. And yet we have these various voices proclaiming a gospel in light of very different kinds of sociologies. And this diversity forms the whole canon, the rule of faith, the whole counsel of God. And one must listen to each of these voices as parts of a whole greater than the sum of its parts. For it is in the whole that we hear the whole counsel of God as revealed in Jesus. Carol Gilligan, I don't know if that's a familiar name to you. Carol Gilligan, student of Lawrence Kohlberg at Harvard, a social psychologist. Have any of you, do you know her? Do you know her work? Very important stuff. Do you know her book, In a Different Voice? Ah. It's a book that you should get and read. I should have Carla talk about it. Carol Gilligan argues that there is a distinctive female voice, the result of socializing and other kinds of forces and factors that has shaped women to see things in distinctive, particular ways, to engage dilemma by different kinds of moral logic. And there's a substantial amount of empirical evidence to prove her point. And that this way of seeing and this way of being, this way of dealing and resolving problems is different from a male voice. And so human society is made of different voices. And the wholeness of any society depends upon hearing and listening and learning from these voices that are sounded in different keys. Now, her catchword is the word complementarity, and that's the word I want you to keep in mind. Complementarity. It is not male over female or antagonistic. It's not a war between two voices. It is not male or female that will destroy a society. It rather must be male and female, speaking in complements, each making the other whole in their understanding of life. Now, I want to take that particular idea and apply it to the New Testament and to the various ideas of discipleship that one finds within the New Testament. It is not Paul versus James or Matthew versus Luke that will destroy any kind of coherent, comprehensive understanding of what it means to be a follower of Christ. It rather is Matthew and Luke, the synoptic voices and the Johannine voice. It must be Paul and Peter. It must be gospel and revelation. It's a complement, and it depends on us hearing each voice clearly and understanding the goods that each biblical voice announces for our edification. The New Testament was formed as a book about discipleship to nurture Christians into disciples. But we must hear all of its variety to understand all of what it means to be a disciple of Christ. Now, it seems to me the implications both for Bible study and for congregational life are enormous. For Bible study, and this is what we will follow for the next couple of weeks, we must, with all of the objectivity we can muster, we must allow each biblical writer to speak. We must understand Matthew's notion of discipleship, and then Mark, and then Luke, and then John, and then Paul, and then James, the writer of Hebrews, Peter, John, Revelation. Each voice must be heard distinctively, clearly. We must understand the differences between these voices. But secondly, we must learn to hear this diversity as forming a whole. It is not thematic unity. It is rather canonical unity. The New Testament includes an inspired diversity. So we need to allow these voices to complement one another. Sometimes that means one will correct another. Other times it will mean one will build on what another voice says. Now the assumption is that whenever one part of the whole is elevated to the exclusion of other parts of the whole, distortion will surely result. A Pauline idea of discipleship elevated to the exclusion of all the other ideas of discipleship found within the New Testament will lead one assuredly to the lunatic fringe. The history of earliest Christianity and the history of contemporary Christianity bears witness to that. The heresy of antinomianism stems from the deeper logic of Pauline preaching, taken to the exclusion of what other voices say in the New Testament. The kind of legalism that one finds in my own Methodistic tradition stems from following too closely, it seems to me, the moral logic of those books that come out of Jewish Christianity. Books like James, 1 Peter, 1 John, Book of Hebrews. Where salvation is not by the unconditional action of a gracious God, but it is by a faithful response of the people of God that one gains the assurance of one's salvation. That's the calculus in my own tradition. And that leads to fear. That leads to legalism. Because it leads away from the forgiving grace of God. One needs to engage all of these voices in conversation. Self-correcting, mutually informing, in complement one to another, in order to get some understanding of the whole counsel of God. Congregationally, by finding this diversity within the biblical word, we are better able, I think, to celebrate it when we find it in our congregation. It allows us to listen as Lutherans to the prayers and to the proclamation of a Methodist or of a Roman Catholic, of a Coptic, of an Orthodox believer. To appreciate, because we hear in their prayers ideas about God that are found within the whole. We are better able to appreciate the peace tradition if we stand on some other side with respect to that particular moral issue. Because we are better able to understand or to hear the voice of Luke's Jesus calling us onto a more pacifist way. And we will hesitate, I hope, to truck out Romans chapter 13, as Lutherans are wont to do, to argue against the peace tradition. We learn to celebrate the contraries. Once we understand that the New Testament, a reflection of God's intention, does not proclaim a monolithic monotheism, but a pluralizing, the gospel of a pluralizing God. Okay, now that gives you, I hope, I mean, this is my own interest, but I hope that it gives you some understanding then of how we are going to proceed. Tomorrow we're going to take up discipleship according to Matthew. And what I'm going to try and do for the first half is to give you a good, hopefully competent summary of how Matthew understands the idea of discipleship. And then I want us to talk about the constructive elements of that idea. How can that produce a more competent, a more effective discipleship? But I want to also take up the dangers of following Matthew to the exclusion of anything else. Embedded in every single voice of the New Testament are potential hazards to Christian discipleship. The New Testament contains its own self-correcting apparatus, and we need to begin to think of diversity in that way. Questions? Contributions? Any other things that need to be said?
Rob?
Yeah.
On PBS, a number of years ago, a person, I don't remember who he was, did a study of Christianity as it appears in the world, and came to the conclusion at the end that sociologically you can demonstrate that Christianity assumes so many forms,
yes,
and so many expressions that one can't even call it, one can hardly even say it has any norm.
Yes.
It can, and I'm sure his point would be that it pretty much is shaped by the culture around it.
Yes.
To be able to live with that culture.
Yes.
And I would assume that's certainly not the intent of the New Testament, but certainly that is a recognition of diversity.
Yeah.
Where does one cross the line, in your opinion, between a celebration of diversity as complementing each other and getting to the point where one is in fact in distortion or is unfaithful to the witness?
Yeah, that's a very good question, very substantial question. I'm going to give you my own response. I do think that while the New Testament tolerates diversity and celebrates diversity, one of the very functions of the New Testament, seems to me, is to limit that. What is the diversity that is tolerated by God and by God's Christ? So that one might say that an expression of religious experience that falls outside of this universe of legitimate interpretations or legitimate possibilities is therefore and thereby not. One also must say, I mean, I spend a lot of my time talking about diversity, but I do think there is unity, and one might even go to the creeds to find that unity. But it seems to me that when one looks across the Christian biblical canon, the First Testament to God and the Second Testament to God, both, one in Israel and one in Christ, that one finds a rather unified picture of God emerging. And it seems to me, and here I'm going to cite again Fiorenza, who is most helpful for me at this point, I think any understanding of a biblical text or any understanding of Christian discipleship that produces a kind of faith in a sort of God that is at odds with that portrait of God that unifies the entire scripture, then we have problems. One of the things that I think Jesus attempts to do as part of his own renewal ministry within Second Temple Judaism is to correct a misinterpretation of the biblical word by mainstream rabbinical Judaism, an interpretation that emphasized an idea of God as elector of a particular people. And thus what was created was a kind of us-them-ism and a sort of religious triumphalism where Jews were able to pronounce, we are the people of God, the Amorites, the Samaritans, the Goyim, the outsiders.
are not, and therefore are not loved by God, are not included in the people that God wants to restore. And I think what Jesus is saying is that is not the biblical God. The biblical God is not that principally of an elector or of an excluder, but one who includes, one who shows mercy on everyone, even the Ninevites, you know, which got Jonah ticked off. I mean, why do we have the book of Jonah in the Old Testament? It's there to remind us that God is not only the God of the Jews, but the God of the Ninevites. And God shows mercy on whomever God desires. And God desires to show mercy on everyone. So I think any kind of interpretation that yields a kind of religion or a kind of spirituality which is exclusive, which portrays an angry God rather than a merciful God. And this is my own tradition, which is in the sort of fundamentalism that you only read about. The idea of God was very much an idea of an angry God. And so we understood the death of Jesus as the satisfaction of God's anger. But you don't find that on Jesus' teaching. Nor do you find it in the principal text that's used to justify it, Romans 3. When you find conservatives talking about the result of Jesus' death as propitiation. Well, it seems to me that they're showing their hand. I mean, they are giving meaning to that word, hilasterion, in terms of their idea of God as an angry God who needs to be satisfied. But it should be expiation. It is a good and merciful and gracious God who transforms that nasty and ugly bad Friday into a good Friday in order to redeem us and restore us. The idea of God that understands Jesus' death as the action of a loving, merciful God, it seems to me, is orthodox. And any kind of